Welcome to the Red Hot Chili Writers Podcast. We're your hosts, Vaseem Khan and Abir Mukherjee, two crime authors ready to expose themselves on air for your titillation, edification and amusement.
We'll be talking life, pop culture and the pursuit of the creative arts, all seasoned with just a dash of garam masala.
As the sound of vuvuzelas mingles with the strident voices of protest in Qatar, location of the ongoing World Cup of football, closer to home, other voices are raised in protest. Here in the UK, we are all set for a winter of discontent as nurses join postal workers, university lecturers and railway staff on strike. But fear not, dear listeners, my co-host and I shall not be downing tools anytime soon, mainly because I doubt that anyone would notice our absence. Abir, how are you, my friend?
Oh, I was good until that introduction. Nobody would notice our absence. Did you hear that, listeners? You would miss us, wouldn't you? If we weren't here, you would miss us. maybe not at first, and maybe not very much, but you would. You'd miss us in the way that you miss, I don't know, an old pair of trousers that you had for a long time that are really comfy. You would miss them, you know, for a while. You would.
Have these trousers been washed for a while?
I think they've been, obviously they've been washed. They're comfy. I mean, you are the left leg. I am the right leg. I think you pushed this analogy a wee bit too far. How are you? No, before I ask you how you are, who have we got on today?
Today we're talking to Peter Hain, Member of Parliament, now turned thriller writer. Peter will be talking to us not only about his political career, but also about growing up in South Africa and opposing apartheid.
And all worthy stuff. So how have you been this week?
I've been terrific. I've actually been sitting back and watching the World Cup of football. Now, I know we've all been accused of hypocrisy on many levels for in any way, shape or form supporting or participating or watching the World Cup of football. And I don't think we need to go into, or maybe for our foreign listeners who are not into football or soccer, as it's called over in America. We should say that there has been some controversy attached to the current World Cup in Qatar because of their rather poor record on human rights and migrant worker pay and deaths and all the rest of it. But the World Cup proceeds. So I've been enjoying watching the matches.
I'll tell you something, though, because like you at the beginning, I was completely of the view that, yeah, this is wrong. And first, it is wrong that in terms of the process by which Qatar was chosen was obviously corrupt. We know that for a fact. We know that there are many, many issues involved there. But I'm also more hesitant now to point the finger. Yes, completely, I agree that their views on sexuality are out of date, do not chime with ours, and, you know, are retrograde. I think there's no doubt about that. However, who are we to point the finger? You know, if you go back 30 years, it was no different here. I don't think it's fair for us to point the finger. You know, it's glass houses.
Well, we'd run out of fingers very quickly, wouldn't we?
We were working on a Qatari building site.
I'm not sure this is the sort of topic we should be joking about. We're going to have loads of people writing in about this.
Let us
go to slightly happier topics. Now, you've been on your travels. You've been out in Iceland. You've been participating in a lit festival, but you've also had the unique pleasure, or not unique, but the rare pleasure of standing under the Northern Lights, the Aurora Borealis.
I was extremely fortunate. I turned up in Iceland on the Friday morning, and it was a wonderful festival, I should point out. Iceland Noir is a very sort of, it's an intimate festival. It's my first time in Iceland. It's weird because the sun only comes up at about 11 at this time of year, and by 3 o'clock it's dark. And so obviously there's a lot of scope for drinking. So I was in the bar drinking, and we stepped outside onto the balcony. It's a rooftop bar. And there it was, the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights. And it was amazing. It's one of the greatest things I've ever seen. And apparently we were very lucky. People have been many times and not seen it. And there we were on the first night, and it was wonderful.
Do you know what I'm going to do for you, my friend? Do you know what I'm going to do for you?
What are you going to do?
Well, the next time we meet, I'm going to recreate the experience for you. I'm going to turn off the lights and bring my little green torch, and I'm going to shine it around on the ceiling, and you will be taken back, transported back to that magical moment.
Should I ask why you have a little green torch?
Doesn't everybody?
What are you eliminating with your little green torch normally? That's what I want to know.
Everybody should have a little green torch.
Everyone should have a little green torch. That's words to live by. Now, the cricket season is over, right?
The cricket season is over, correct. Well done. And
did you win any awards this year in your cricket? Because your cricket, you know, career is something of beauty and magnificence.
Are you referring to the fact that I am currently knee-deep in cricket awards season, where basically we hold a bunch of dinners? So
absolutely. I, whenever I invite you somewhere, I can't come because I'm going to a cricket award dinner. And yet I never see any trophies. So what are you actually doing at these? Are you just taking people's coats or something?
Do you know what? Just for that, I will tweet a picture of me holding up three very big trophies. Our club is very successful and we win a bunch of trophies. Now, it must be said that the leagues that we play in have a habit of giving trophies for everything. So you turn up, you wear your whites the right way round, you get a trophy. So
did you get that one then?
I tell you what I want to mention. So we were having a discussion the other day, you, myself, and a few of our other writer friends, about anxiety and the fact that this is a particular time of year where a lot of people face stress and anxiety. And I've been fiddling with writing a piece about this. And as I was doing so, I came across some rather interesting things about that people can do to reduce stress and anxiety. And one of those was meditation. Now, I've never been a meditation person, but I discovered, and I did not know this, that there are actually many different types of meditation. Would you like to hazard a guess?
The number or types?
Well, yeah, just how many types of meditation do you think there are?
I'm going to say there are at least 26.
Well, no, but there is at least 8 to 9 that I have discovered.
Okay.
Do you want to hear about some of these?
Yeah, go on then.
And you have to tell me whether or not you practice this form of meditation or you think you could.
Okay, go for it. I think some of these are going to be linked to things like Buddhism, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Go for it. Okay, well, I'm not going to interrupt you.
So I'm going to ask you. So the first one, I don't think you're probably very qualified to do, and that is the loving kindness meditation.
What? I'd be brilliant. I'd be absolutely fantastic.
Okay, wait a second.
And I would smash your face in if you disagree.
Based on your conduct, both on and off this show, right, that's why I say that you're probably not very good at this. So
what?
The goal of this, right, listen to this. The goal of this is to cultivate an attitude of love and kindness towards everything, even a person's enemies and sources of stress.
Well, you are my main source of stress in the entire world. So can I not be nice to everybody but you? Surely that's got to count for something.
What about this one? Have you practiced progressive muscle relaxation?
Yes. I think every time I burp and expel gas, is that not muscle relaxation?
Well, it could be, because apparently it starts from your feet and then you progressively move upwards throughout your body. So I guess you stop at when you get to your ass, or otherwise known as your head.
And this is why I love everyone but you.
This one, I'm sure we've all practiced. Breathing awareness meditation.
Oh, yeah. A lot of these are linked to yoga. So the second one, the muscle relaxing thing, I've done that in yoga where they say, like, start with your head, relax this, let your neck go, and then further down. The breathing one, again, is a yoga one, isn't it?
Okay, we've just lost half of our listeners because they've had to picture you in some sort of yoga lycra.
I think we've just gained a lot of listeners, my friend.
What about,
ladies and gentlemen, welcome, first timers, to the Yoga Hour with Abir and Vass. Sorry, carry on.
mantra-based meditation.
Oh yes, that's quite, that's again quite Buddhist and quite Hinduist, Hindu. Oh.
Okay, so what mantra would you?
Well, the one that's quoted a lot is the one that, you know, I learned when I was 13, which goes Om Bhur Bhuvasya Tatsavitu Bharanang Bharadevasya. It just goes on like this, right? So I couldn't tell you what it means anymore, but essentially you're repeating this chant over and over again. And I think there's also a form of Buddhism called Nichiren Buddhism, where you repeat the phrase Nam Myoho Renge Kyo over and over and over again. And I think that's a form of meditation as well. Yeah, that's another chant-based meditation.
All right, I'll give you one more.
Hey, surprise! You didn't expect that, did you, smart arse?
No, I didn't.
You didn't expect me to come up with those answers. You see where the real brains of this outfit are?
Well, I thought you were going to start going on about belly. Based meditation.
Oh, tell me about that. I don't.
You're very qualified for that one.
tell me about belly meditation, because well, I might try this.
It's just another form of breathing where the focus is entirely on the stomach region. I'll give you one more.
How does that work? How do you breathe through your stomach? Is that like when you're pregnant and you get told to do J breaths? I don't know.
It doesn't really tell us how exactly. All right, one more. Guided meditation. Now, I recently had to sit through one of these. My wife and I were on holiday in Corfu, and she signed us up without me realizing for a mindfulness session, which ended up involving us just lying on mats and a recorded voice droning on for about 30 minutes, and we had to listen to it. Have you ever done anything like that?
Well, I would imagine that our listeners go through this every week, listening to us, do they not? You know, probably sitting there doing the ironing and these two idiots droning on. So you're welcome. There you are. It's a podcast and it's meditation.
Before we go and speak to Peter, I just want to say one thing, because you've been mentioning the Buddhist monks, right? There was this, it reminded me of a great story that came out. A temple in Thailand where all the monks were sacked. Or they had to leave because they all failed a drugs test.
Oh, I read the headline. I didn't read the article. Tell me about it.
Well, they all had to have a urine test. And the tests reveal that they had been taking illegal drugs. And this is a very small temple in a province called Phetchabun in Thailand. It was raided by the police and they were forced to undergo these tests. Somebody must have dobbed them in.
That's I don't know. I've got a bit of sympathy for Buddhist monks taking drugs, simply because, you know, when I was researching opium addiction, you know, it's linked to a lot of that stuff. The book I read was about a guy who went to a Buddhist ashram to cure himself of opium addiction, and it was just throwing up an awful lot, so they made them drink this potion day in, day out, and just to clear the system. So yeah, I always thought it went the other way around. I thought you went to a Buddhist ashram or Buddhist temple rather to cure yourself of these things rather than to hook yourself on it.
Maybe they were just bored of their day-to-day existence.
You know, to be fair, for a lot of recorded history, hallucinogenic things, drugs, were linked to spirituality, weren't they? And they were linked to religion.
Well, they still are in certain cultures, right? Yeah. I mean, I hope I'm not saying anything wrong, untoward by saying Rastafarianism.
Yeah.
Believes in that. Okay.
So, yeah, it's not as shocking as you would think. It's only the Church of England that doesn't like crack cocaine.
Well, let's go and talk to somebody who we know would never fail a urine test. Shall we talk to Lord Peter Haynes?
That's just the worst segue ever. Let's talk to Lord Peter Haynes. Today we're chatting to Peter Haynes, also known as the Right Honourable the Lord Haynes, career politician, now turned thriller writer. Peter will be talking to us about politics, opposing apartheid, and his new novel, The Elephant Conspiracy. Peter, Lord Haynes, welcome to the Red Hot Chili Writers.
Well, thank you very much. Great to be on, and it was good of you to invite me. And never mind the Lord, I'm just Peter for you guys.
Well, thank you. Well, you say that, but you have come dressed the part of the Lord. You've come dressed in suit and tie.
Sorry about that, but I'm just come from a meeting in the Lord's and I'm going back off to another event. So I just dressed this way, I'm afraid. It's not typical crime writer's gear, is it, really?
No, you are probably one of the smartest people we've had on, in all senses of the word.
Preemptive insult.
Well, we were just saying before that we usually have to tell our guests to put some more clothes on, but you've really outdone everyone we've ever had on the show.
Let's start at the beginning. Tell us a wee bit about where you grew up.
Well, I was a child of anti-apartheid parents growing up in Pretoria in South Africa. So then my entire childhood was spent there. And increasingly, in the late 1950s and early 1960s, when I was 10 and then into my early teens, they got more and more involved as a young white couple. I'm very proud of them, actually, because they didn't need to take a stand. 99.9% of whites went along with the apartheid system. So our life became consumed by this, living on the one hand a normal life and on the other hand a very abnormal one compared with my school friends and my cousins, having the special branch raiding our house, my mother and father arrested when I was 11 years old and woken up in the middle of the night to be told that. And of course they were then issued with banning orders, which is another story entirely, and finally forced to leave the country because they stopped my dad working as an architect. So we had
My wife is from Durban and she's of Indian origin from South Africa.
Right.
Not many people know the stories of the whites actually stood up. And if you read Cry Freedom, you see the sorts of things that were done to people who stood against the regime. I think there was one point where the security services sent T-shirts to the kids of white supporters, of anti-apartheid activists. They sent them T-shirts covered in some sort of poisonous material just to...
Yes, which burnt the little girl's skin, which is obviously... And that was deliberately sent by the security police. They did some terrible things. They tortured, they assassinated, they sent letter bombs to anti-apartheid leaders. I got one, actually, in the early 1970s in London, by which time we were well into living here, having had to leave the country. And fortunately, didn't go off, but it is the kind that assassinated anti-apartheid leaders across the world.
Can I just ask you, just going back one step? So usually when you have people like your parents who stand up for the rights of people that they really don't have to stand up for the rights for because of the environment that they live in, there's some catalyst. It's either somebody close to them, some incident that they've seen close to them. Was there such a catalyst for your parents?
Not a single one, not a single catalyst. But I tried to get to the bottom of this when I wrote their story, published in 2014, called Adam Wall Values, Duty and Sacrifice in Apartheid South Africa, because they were pretty well alone amongst their relatives, some of them whom turned their backs on us. But there were brave whites who did take a stand. In their case, it's a very complex story as to why they did exceptionally amongst their family to take that stand. I think my dad served in the Second World War in fighting the Nazis in Italy for the South African Army. And I think that gave him a wider perspective on the world, because white South Africans lived in a very cocooned environment in which they didn't really choose to know what was going on and the misery being suffered by their black and Indian countrymen. It's hard to know with my parents exactly what spurred them, but I'm proud that they were.
And before we come on to the books, just a quick question. What was it like, that transition, leaving as a child from glorious South Africa to miserable, cold, wet Britain?
Well, it wasn't very good, to be perfectly frank. I mean, we left in the end of the summer and we arrived in grey, drizzly London, being put up in a friend's house. My parents came without any money. My dad just had a job to go to. And then to start a whole new life. It was very traumatic for my younger brother and two sisters who found it really, really tough. I just got stuck in doing things and later in getting involved in what turned out to be a leading role in the anti-apartheid movement in stopping all white South African sports teams by running on the pitch at Twickenham and Lord's Cricket Ground and so on, and physically stopping them. Because they, if you were black or Indian, you couldn't play for your country, even if you were the best. So that, for example, the Springboks have a captain, the Springbok rugby team has a black captain on merit, brilliant player, Siya Kolisi, who hoisted the World Cup in 2019. 50 years ago, when we were stopping all white sports tours here by physically stopping them, running on the pitch, etc., he would not have been able to play for his country. And the leader of South African rugby at the time said, "Over my dead body, will there ever be a black Springbok?" Well, of course, 50 years later, there was.
I think I read this somewhere when I was doing the research for this. There was a particular incident when you were a teenager. You made a speech at, was it an execution or a hanging of an activist? And that sort of
a family friend, the only white to be hung in the freedom struggle, well over 100 black political activists were hung from the neck, a grisly medieval process that still went on in South Africa. And that was extremely traumatic for us, because he was a close family friend, a teacher, and it had a very big impact on my life as a kid and my family as a whole.
But why were you picked to do the speech instead of, say, your parents?
My mother and father were both issued with banning orders. And banning orders meant you couldn't speak in public, you couldn't meet more than one other person at a time, you couldn't communicate with another banned person. So they banned my mother in 1963, and a year later they banned my dad. So they had to be given special permission to talk to each other exceptionally as banned people, provided they didn't talk to any other banned people in the world, but only themselves as husband and wife. There was an Orwellian side to apartheid. My dad wrote the funeral address. It wasn't a narration, but I was the only one really who could read it out. And I was 15 at the time. Pretty scary thing to do, especially pressing the button that sent his coffin to be cremated. That was quite a tough thing to do.
And Lord Hayne, that seems that seems to be your induction into political activism.
It was anti-apartheid politics was in my DNA, and politics was as a whole from my youth and then all the way through finally to get, though I never intended to be an MP and I certainly never intended to be a Lord. I didn't plan a career of any kind, and I didn't expect to be a government minister or a cabinet minister, which I was for 12 years.
In a more sane and sensible time. We really want to talk about all that, but I feel we should talk about the books first, and then start back. So why thrillers? Why? Tell us a wee bit about this.
Well, I read thrillers for relaxation. In my life, I have to read too many documents and heavy books and things. And I've written what I hope are readable current affairs books, over 20 of them. But because I like thrillers, I read Gerald Seymour and David Baldacci and Sam Bourne. And then I've got to read Sarah Saltoun recently, a very interesting new writer. She gets under your skin, really. I don't know if you've read her book. So that's my kind of relaxation. And so I thought, well, I'd like to try my hand at it, at doing it. And the interest was in doing so was sparked by visiting a safari park in South Africa in 2015 and seeing the rhinos being guarded 24/7 and then learning about the extent of poaching and the war zones that safari parks had become between rangers trying to protect this precious wildlife from becoming extinct, and rhinos and elephants are on the edge of that, and lions too, I found out more recently. So understanding that and being really interested in wildlife, and then realizing how corrupt South Africa had become under former President Zuma, where corruption was just rampant and he was looting the state from the top, from the presidential office, and corrupting the whole of the society.
had a bit of help from a bunch of an Indian family as well, though. I mean, come on, he didn't do it all himself. There were Indians involved.
There were three, absolutely three business brothers.
Yeah, the Gupta family,
who were basically working arm in arm with him. Yeah. And yeah, absolutely. And they had to flee into exile in order to escape the police.
So tell us a wee bit about the book itself.
Well, it was that genesis of wildlife threat with extinction and then corruption that I realized that on research that there were international crime syndicates going all the way into East Asia, places like China and Vietnam, behind the local poachers, paying them pitiful amounts, and they risk their lives. And then these guys hoover up the rhino horns, grind it down for powder, for all sorts of rich elite purposes, and then the elephant tusks for ivory. And so there were these international crime syndicates protected by corrupt politicians along their route to East Asia where they sold. And so I thought I'd write about it and constructed the Rhino Conspiracy, published a few years ago, and now its sequel, The Elephant Conspiracy. And I wasn't sure whether I could manage to do it at the pace that was needed, but people have been kind enough to say that I did. I don't know what you guys made of it. But also construct real characters.
Yeah, well, I really enjoy it. I mean, in my other life, I work in at UCL in a university department, and we look at crime and security issues. And we've actually done quite a bit of work on poaching.
All right.
Well, we had a PhD student go over and live in Uganda for 3 years, looking at some of the issues that you actually deal with in your novels. And everything you say is correct. A lot of it is to do with organized crime networks that are aiding and abetting this particular type of crime. But then you've also got the demand side of it, which is cultural to a great extent. The desire for the ivory, the desire for shark's fin soup, all the other things that
these rich elite fetishes, basically.
They're fetishes. Yeah. They're nothing more than cultural fetishes.
I mean, they use rhino horn ground down for aphrodisiacs.
Precisely.
Precisely. Substitutes. There's no evidence that...
None whatsoever.
Does that affect it?
It's cultural, it's social, sometimes it's religious. And until we get a grip of that, and that changes very slowly because that is seeped into a particular culture. And those cultures we're talking about are enormous. Without shaming any particular country in the world, we're talking about millions upon millions of people who believe in this and are willing to...
There's economic clout there as well. And if you're living in Africa and you're earning, you know, whatever, $1 a day... The idea of making money that can change your family's life through this sort of thing. I mean,
like killing a rhino or whatever. Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, I don't know if either of you remember the great film with Sigourney Weaver based on the life story of Diane Fossey. But the extent to which poachers are willing to, as you said, Abir, because they earn no money. For them, it's worth risking their life, committing murder, to carry on doing this trade.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Horrible.
So let's talk a wee bit more about that. I mean, the elephant conspiracy. Tell us a wee bit about without giving away any spoilers. Tell us a wee bit about the plot.
Well, what it is about is a number of activists, if I could call them that. Who are a small band of people. One is called the Sniper, who actually is portrayed on a real person I happened to meet, who was at Nelson Mandela's, when Nelson Mandela walked to freedom from prison in February 1990, having spent 20 years inside, 27 years. There was actually, I discovered afterwards, though nobody knew this, a sniper above the place, keeping an eye and not on doing anything to protect him from anybody trying to kill him. So I constructed a character based on him, and who then got introduced to the wildlife part to try and take out the poachers. So the Rhino Conspiracy involves him very significantly. And then he plays a very different role in the Elephant Conspiracy, which is a more offensive role in, as it were, wider society in dealing with some of the bad guys.
So will there be a third in this? Will this be a trilogy?
I wrote the Rhino Conspiracy initially as a kind of a hobby over 3 years. And then Muswell Press, a great publishing house, small, but terrific to work with, two sisters, Sarah and Kate Beale. And they liked it so much, which was a bit surprised me. And they liked the characters. And they said, we want to know what happens to the characters. So then they said, you've got a year to write another one, which became the Elephant Conspiracy. I was under a lot of pressure to write that because I'm pretty busy in, as it were, my non-thriller writing life. And now, having published that, I've started and I'm 50,000 words into a third one.
I think Abir and I should guess the animal.
I'm going to say Crocodile Conspiracy.
No, it's not the Crocodile Conspiracy.
Nobody's poaching crocodiles. I think it should be the Squirrel Conspiracy, because what's happened to all the red squirrels? You know, where are they all gone? I miss the red squirrels.
No. I mentioned one of the big five animals in passing in a few minutes ago. It might give you a clue.
A lion?
I'm saying nothing.
Okay. Hippo?
No, it's not a hippo. Yeah. It's not a hippo.
Giraffe.
Well, by the way, these animals are all hunted, but the lions are the ones. There are now fewer lions than there are rhinos. And I didn't realize that until a few weeks ago.
Well, can we just say that we would like you to become more of a thriller writer? I mean, the politics, let's talk about the politics, okay? What's happened to the world over the last 10 years? We seem to have gone a bit insane, not just the world, but this country in particular. And maybe that's because I'm biased or because I'm from Glasgow, but the world seemed a better place in 2010. Or our country seemed a better place in 2010 than it does.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm biased. I was in the last Labour government, and I'm a Labour politician. But, you know, when you look at the state of the health service now, when you look at the state of the railways, when you look at the state of schools, where head teachers are desperately trying to make their budgets work and deliver in the classroom, and the National Health Service is teetering on the brink of collapse, and you know, nurses are having to strike to get a decent pay level, and the railways are in chaos. You know, I think the world was a lot better a place in 2010, regardless of the Ukraine war and COVID and the energy crisis and the cost of living and all of that. You know, I think we've got to get back to a society where we're prepared to pay a little more in taxation in order to fund the services that we all depend on. Decent, you know, health, decent schools, decent, you know, rewarding the people, including, by the way, the train drivers, rewarding the people who basically make our lives tick and enable us to do the things we want to do.
Well, I think
we both agree with you on that. I suppose my question is, well, at the moment, where is the money going? Why is it lining the pockets of the rich? Why is it going in PPP contracts that don't lead to anything? Why is it going in test and trace that doesn't work? How much wastage has there been? And how much essential? I mean, we talked about Zuma. we may be at a different level, but the corruption at the top.
Yeah. Contracts going to mates of ministers without proper sort of tendering processes. Now, they used the excuse that the urgency of the situation was so great that they had to just get the PPE produced and so forth, having kind of not prepared for this pandemic, which as a Labour government, we had set up a unit to prepare for it, but that's another story. But I actually think it goes back to a more fundamental thing. Around about 1980, the coming to power of Margaret Thatcher here in Britain and Ronald Reagan in the US, there was an abandonment of the post-Second World War consensus of what's called Keynesian economics, where you had government investing to support the business sector with research and development, proper infrastructure, building millions of houses after the Second World War, and all of that kind of thing, and trying to build up decent public services. Not saying they were perfect, but that was all turned around by a neoliberal economic agenda in which the public sector became bad and everything private became good and everything had to be outsourced. Now, I'm in favor of a strong private sector, but also a flourishing public sector to work on arm in arm.
Do you cast your eye across the pond and across the world in general and look at the kind of politics that appears to be very popular now? You know, you can call it, you can call it populism. You can call it strongman politics. Things have obviously changed in the last 30 odd years since you've been in.
For the worse. Yeah, well, my dad used to say to me when I was young and growing up and becoming more politically involved, he used to say, you know, human civilization is advancing. African and other countries that were occupied by colonial powers like Britain are becoming independent. So this is in the 60s and 70s and so on. Women are getting more rights. Racism is being pushed back. And, you know, people, are, you know, we're better off than our parents were, and you'll be better off than we were. That's all gone into reverse.
Yeah.
Kids today are not better off than my generation. They're worse off. And my grandkids are going to be a lot worse off, unable to get houses, you know, paying enormous rents for various cramped accommodation, all of that kind of thing, paying off big student debts. And I think that's also created a lot. And then you've had deindustrialization of working class jobs. In a constituency like I represented, Neath in South Wales, a former mining constituency with a lot of heavy industry, people weren't paid, you know, a king's ransom, but they had jobs of which they were proud, they were recognized, they had security, they were members of trade unions, and they had a place in society. And that's all gone.
The trend that we see is a lack of seriousness amongst politicians these days. It seems to me that the politicians that we grew up with had a gravitas. Now, and that's on all sides. We see this lack of, I can't remember.
Present company accepted.
Present company. We're of the generation that still had gravitas, right? Yeah. I mean, Gordon Brown made his mistakes, but I would class him as the last sort of statesman or politician of gravitas to be prime minister that we had.
Definitely.
It's our generation, perversely. It's Vasim and my generation who seem to be fundamentally unserious. And the carpetbaggers that are in politics nowadays seem to be from our generation.
Yes.
What is that?
I mean, a lot of people in politics are still genuine, but there are too many carpetbaggers, and they tended to have risen to the top, at least, you know, not in my party, but elsewhere. And I think it's also, you know, I get asked a lot by young people, say, what advice could you give me as a career in politics? And I said, politics is not a career. Politics is a mission. Politics is about what you believe and whether you think you can try and make a change through becoming a local councillor or a member of a devolved government or an MP or whatever. It's not something you set out to become an MP and you take a politics degree and then you get a researcher job and then, you know, that's the wrong route into politics.
It's very much like being an author. It's a mission. Don't expect to earn any money, at least
exactly.
At the beginning of your career anyway.
Right,
Peter, I know you've got to rush off and do some parliamentary things and we're coming up to the half hour. But to finish with, let's go back into the world of books. Now, we've already asked you what you're working on next. You haven't revealed which animal you're
I've given you a fairly hint.
We just know it's not a squirrel. That's all we know at this point.
It's not a squirrel. So tell us instead, what sort of books do you read? So you've told us about thrillers, but when you were growing up, what sort of formed the foundation of your reading experience?
George Orwell's Homage to Catalonia was quite influential on me and was formative in terms of, you know, as a socialist, where I fitted into the spectrum. And he was about decentralizing power, not everything controlled by the state. And he was also very iconoclastic about the sectarianism on the left. Yeah. So he was quite influential. Alan Paton's Cry, The Beloved Country, obviously my South African background, was as a masterpiece. Those are amongst the ones that I read in my formative years politically. And a lot of other, you know, I devoured political books on the left and read far more in my late teens and early 20s than I have time to now. I'm writing too many things now to actually read what I want to read.
Well, you have been absolutely wonderful to talk to. And you've brought some much needed gravitas, as Abir just stated, to the show.
Is that a compliment or a criticism?
Very much a compliment.
Oh, that's very kind.
Because like your parents, Abir and I have been banned by many parties, but not for any noble cause, just for opening our mouths.
We get banned from different types of parties, though, don't we? That's different. But Peter, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I'm sure our audience will love this. The new book, The Elephant Conspiracy, when is it out?
It's just out, just published.
Just out now. So
Yeah. By Muswell Press.
And it's in all good bookshops now. Peter Hain, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
And that brings us to the close of another episode. Once again, if you've liked the show, can we ask you to please leave a review, sign up for regular episodes using your favourite podcast app, and please do spread the word. Vasim, Lord Khan, do you think we should head into the jungle and tackle some evil poachers?
Well, I'm not sure that's a good idea. A pair of handsome chaps like us, I think we might end up as a pair of prized trophies.
Yeah, that's true. My head, your buttocks on somebody's wall, on somebody's dining room wall, that would not be pleasant. Ladies and gentlemen, until the next episode, we have been your friends, the Red Hot Chili Writers.